Hello, Tim.
Hello.
Are you all right?
I'm all right.
Back for series two?
Series two already. It doesn't feel like last month we had series one, does it?
I don't think we did have series one last month.
No, I don't.
Hi, I'm Steve Rick.
And I'm Tim Elliott.
And welcome to the RE of Marketing podcast.
A podcast where we rethink, replay and remark on all good things to do with branding and marketing. We're very proactive at this podcasting malarkey.
Yes, because it's the only thing that we're good at, which is actually just talking to each other rather than actually doing any form of work.
Yeah. If it was any more technical than hitting record on Zoom, we'd have a real issue, I think. But that's what Charlie's for, maybe.
Yeah, good. Thanks very much, Charlie. I like my media for last series and cleaning up as best as you could from my dulcet robotic audio tones.
Yeah.
Hopefully this season will be a bit better because I've moved room. But there we go.
There we go. You can keep this bit in, Charlie. It's all a bit of a promotion. You don't have to weird it out. This is good.
Keep it in for yourself.
Good podcast material, this.
Yeah. It's all about your personal brand now, Charlie.
A strong start, Charlie. Strong start. Anyway. Anyway, moving on from Charlie because weird start. We've decided to change it up in the second series or the second season, and the last season it was just me and him talking discussing stuff and sharing our opinions. This time we're going to bring guests in, and today's episode is number one of season two, and it's containing a guy called Michael Owen. Not him, not the footballer. Michael,
yeah,
Owen.
I think he did that joke in the first season a couple of times as well, but that's, it's fine, carry on,
it's good. I mean, people are still listening, right? We'll still have some.
It's Michael moments. With a Y as well, isn't it? Not.
I think that's his brand. His nice name.
Is it? Okay.
He's branded it, so he's a brand guy. Oh. And he's really good. We have mentioned him before on this podcast, if you have listened to any of the other ones. If not, Michael Owen is an English guy from the Northeast area. And he's got a very successful agency and brand history until kind of recent years, where he's gone off that track, off the traditional agency track, I would say. And he's launched a clothing line, which we'll be talking about today, called Always Wear Red, and how he's built that brand and what he plans to do with it. And a really brilliant blog that I like called 50 Odd, 50 Odd. Where from his 50th birthday, he's pledged to write a post a day for 10,000 posts or something.
Yeah, is it 3,650 posts? It's over the next 10 years.
10 years.
So between 50 and 60, yeah.
10 years. And he's really good. He's one of our type of folks. He's a bit opinionated. He doesn't mind sharing the opinions, and he's very honest with what he thinks and why he thinks it, and the state of the universe, the creative universe, I would say. So we're really looking forward to guest number one.
Looking forward to it. I've been doing a little bit of listening and reading of Michael's stuff, and he is somebody who drives his own path. So, you know, when we talk about those agency things that you were just discussing there, Tim, he decided to have... instead of setting up a big agency with different departments, he decided to set up different companies and different agencies that were specialists in what they do. And I thought that was absolutely genius. I've never heard that before. And I thought, what a clever idea.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about agencies before and the agency model and how full service agencies are, you know, they're founded on one particular skill, and then you cobble in other stuff.
That's right.
To kind of support that.
The customer says, I need this. And you go, oh, we'll take that for you. We'll do it.
Yeah, you don't want to bring in another agency because, you know, in agency world, right, they just contradict you. And every agency has their own little mission and plan and method and framework that they like to claim is amazing, I imagine, or way of working. And it's often contradictory, not collaborative. Which I like, a much more collaborative thing. But Michael obviously very intelligent man, and did away with all that and just did one thing really well and referred it to his other things that did that thing really well.
Yeah, very clever.
Today's show, we have our very first guest on the RE of Marketing podcast. It's a guy who I've discovered recently over the COVID lockdown times, actually, and through a guy I know who lives up the road from me, in theory, about 10 miles away, Mr. Mark Shaler, who's got a wonderful community of people as part of his communion that he does every Monday, the do lectures and stuff like that, a really good group of people. And I discovered our guest today, Mr. Michael Owen, through that. It was specifically about the Another Door Festival, which I think was on Facebook Live. And I tuned in through that festival and I heard Michael talk. I think he was one of the first speakers. And he brought up a question of asking himself a question about what are you for? And as you know from me and Steve, we're very purpose driven. And that sort of question really gets me thinking, because I'm at the ripe old age of 43 where I'm really assessing what am I for, because I've done all the agency background along with Steve and client services and stuff like that, and that's not what work is about anymore. So I'd like to welcome one of my favourite writers and favourite people to follow in the social world, Mr. Michael Owen. Hello, Michael.
Morning. Oh, I won't say morning because I won't time stamp it. Hello.
Yeah, you can time stamp away. Please do.
It's very informal, this episode. Yeah. I'm sure we'll get more professional as it goes. But thanks for agreeing to come on. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for asking me. Thank you very much.
No problem. No problem at all. So, Michael, do you want to give us a bit of a background into yourself and your current projects and stuff like that?
Yeah, the short story of me is I'm a furniture designer by training. That's my degree. Then I worked for universities and enterprise agencies, helping people to start businesses for about 10 years. Then I started my first business in the year 2000, which was a creative agency. And then because I believe in narrowly focused brands, I had like a brand consultancy and a creative agency and a digital agency and a web support services company. Am I going too fast? I'm going too fast for me.
No, you're not. Not at all.
So that's what I did for 15 years. But then I got to my mid-40s, and as you've just said, I thought, I wonder if I'm any good. You know, I wonder if I could actually build a, you know, because we got to a seven-figure turnover, there were 20 or 30 people milling about, but I wasn't fulfilled. I was making money, spending it on a load of crap I shouldn't be spending it on, living a life that, you know, me and Lisa, my other half, we got the five-bedroom house with the gates that went like that when you click something on your keys. And then we split up because she had to listen to me going on all day, and it's like, oh, that's no good. So we sold that house, lost a six-figure sum on that house, so I'm really good with property, moved back to a smaller house, and we're fine. Well, I think we are. She's just gone out, so I'm not sure. And then we've got a little four-year-old, so we're fine. But the point was, we painted this picture of what we thought we wanted, which was rubbish when we actually got it. These gates, you know, oh, I can press a button and my gate's open. A man turns up and says, I've just oiled your gate. That's 105 quid, please. I always remember these things. You know, these things, 105 quid for oiling my gate. So all that's gone. All that's gone. So now I run three little brands, okay? So one of them is Always Wear Red, which is a purpose-driven clothing brand. The second thing is, it took me 50 years to be brave enough to name a company after me. So I've got this company called Michael Now, which is basically a brand consultancy with a slogan of helping people to build braver brands, because I think that business is generally quite boring. And then finally, on my 50th birthday, which was 2 years ago, as you mentioned, I started to write a story a day, and I've committed to writing a story a day for 10 years, and that's on a website called 50 Odd. So the three things I do are Always Wear Red, Michael, and 50 Odd.
Brilliant, brilliant. We've mentioned in our series one, actually, 50 Odd came up quite a bit, especially in the early episodes when we were really mixed Corona, and you wrote a post comparing all of the same TV adverts, if you remember that, And we used that as the platform, didn't we, Steve? To
yeah, we did.
To say the same message of you, of Jesus Christ, stop being boring. Like, it's like everybody's the same. So we've used and mentioned your blog, our listeners, of which we have, we're getting, I don't know, what, 50-odd downloads a week, aren't we, at the moment, which is all right for a new bit.
So we're as surprised as anybody else.
Yeah, we're as surprised as anyone else, which is nice. But we've used it quite a lot, so people are familiar of our opinions on that. But what we wanted to talk to you today specifically, because it's kind of relevant, it is the theme of purpose and the backstory to Always Wear Red, because you're about to launch a new range, a new series, are you not?
Yeah, Always Wear Red. The concept was on the 14th of February 2015. I launched it on the 14th of February 2016 because I told social media, you know, my following of like one at the time, which grew between February 2015 and February 2016. I have to give myself deliverables or I don't do it. So I told the world, maybe a couple of people, I was going to launch. And Always Wear Red, actually, I've done the cardinal sin in branding is to shift the brand position. But I have, because when I launched the brand, it was all about the creation of confidence and the relationship between what we wear and how we behave. But I fell in love with a different cause. So I shifted the cause and I've shifted the product range. But because I'd never done clothing before, I wanted, out of my insecurities, I wanted to have the best of everything, which made it quite expensive, of course, limited runs, working with the best makers in the United Kingdom with the best materials in the world. But I learned so much. And then to come back to what you've just mentioned, Tim, I fell in love with knitting, hand knits, actually, because when I started researching hand knits, they were bloody expensive. You know, a Gucci hand knit, Gucci, of course, is $4,000 to $15,000, okay? So I thought, hang on, that's why would they do that? I mean, we know that the luxury brands increase the actual direct cost by 5 to 9 times on average. Yeah. But I said, what's going on? So I had a look at it, and it is bloody expensive to do. So my hand knits are going to be 4 figures, but just not that much, between 1,000 and 2,000, actually. But I love the idea that it was so hard to scale, so mad to control quality, and actually quite hard to find somebody who can consistently provide you with wonderfully well-made merino wool. I put all these things together and I thought, that's why no one's doing this really well, because it's really hard. So I'm going to be the guy who creates the best hand knits in the world, because I actually couldn't find someone who made that claim, but who could evidence the fact that they'd done all they could to have a wonderful, you know, a thing that was going to last longer than you are, and you want to hand out to your kids, and that was each click of the needle was considered. So that's where I am. And the last thing to say on this is, on the subject of purpose, which you've mentioned, I do know what the brand's for, and it's to encourage you to do nothing, because the jumpers, which I've designed in inverted commas, I can make tables and chairs, but can I make jumpers? Time will tell. I don't make them. Someone else makes them, but I design them. But the point is this, it's that jumper you put on that makes you go, it's supposed to be, all right, just leave me alone, go away. Tim, your phone's ringing. I've got my jumper on, just fucking leave me alone. It's that, because I had one. Do you remember, are we old enough to remember a Starsky cardigan?
Yes. Yeah, Starsky and Hutch.
I've got one, I think.
Tim still wears his every day.
So when I was little, my mum knitted me a Starsky cardigan, and we saw Paul Michael Glazier, I think, come out of a swimming pool soaking wet with a big cardigan. That's what it's based on. So it's part of my boyhood, if you like, but it's the best hand knit that I could possibly make with you know, I've only got 4 or 5 years of experience working with the best makers and materials. But the purpose of the brand, just to say one more time, it's about your downtime. It's something to wear when you're doing nothing, with the little line of, you know, the times we do nothing can mean everything, because we're supposed to be with our kids and our family and just mucking about. So anyway, that's that.
Did you approach the business from because merino wool is quite niche, like you did with your agencies? Was it something that you had a passion in in knitwear and clothing, or did you look at it from a big business perspective and go, actually, there's a big market here where nobody's really engaging at the level that I want to engage at or where I want to purchase at?
It definitely wasn't the business thing, because I'm not making any money. Orwell's Red hasn't made any money. It's the investment somewhere between 100 and 150,000, and the amount that's coming is probably three quarters of that figure, you know. The tipping point will happen. I can only make 300 of them a year. Okay, so we know if I'm successful based on those numbers and the fact that, you know, they cost between 1,000 and 2,000 each, and we actually, you know, we actually increase the price by between 2 and 3 times as opposed to 5 to 9 times. You know the margins, the turnover. So it's not going to make you rich, actually. Within 2 years, I'll know whether this makes sense. Because the Simon Sinek thing, you know, I'm not looking for people who want to buy what I'm selling. I'm looking for people who believe what I believe. So it's the other thing you said. You know, I believe that the most important times of your life are not the bits where, you know, when I was building agencies and you gentlemen were doing whatever you gentlemen were doing, working hard. I want to be doing the other thing.
I heard a really good thing the other day, which was, we all talk about work-life balance and things like that, which is what you're alluding to. And actually, there is no such thing as work-life balance anymore. Mm. It's all about work integration now, which is so. Live your life and make work for you at the same time.
Yeah. And this morning I was waffling on elsewhere about the 8-8-8 thing. Apparently 8 hours sleep, 8 hours work, 8 hours doing some things which are fed by the other two. So you're lively enough to bloody enjoy it or do it well, and you've made a few quid when you're working, but try and make your work something you like doing. So Always Wear Red doesn't make sense commercially yet, but I'm hoping that it might one day.
Well, there's been some really good brand stories around and background stories of kind of sustainable, of short run, really kind of personal, really meaningful clothing. Like, do you know Painter Jackets? Have you seen?
Yeah,
Painter Jackets. So we've spoke about those as well before, and they've just released their batch 5, I think, or something, or batch 4. But they do a very small run, I think a 600-700 or something like that. And they released it at 9 a.m. last Saturday and sold out at 9:02.
The thing is, I was lucky enough to meet Hugh and Becky, isn't it, a partner. Yes. So as you know, Hugh used to be the marketing manager at Hyatt Jeans, so worked with David. And Painter is a phenomenon, I would suggest, in that, you know, you're quite right. The first three runs were 300, the fourth one 750, the fifth one, they flipped the business model, haven't they? And they want 75 quid off us as a down payment for number 5, which I would predict will sell on, you know, maybe up to 5,000, because their database is huge. Painter are, in my opinion, the masters at the detailed storytelling. And you know, you don't pay two or 300 quid for a jacket if you don't care about the process as much as the product. But it's a simple little thing that they're making, but they make us care about the process as much as the product, don't they? And they've done a red one, which is the reason why I did put a down payment on the fifth one, because I said to Hugh, you've not done a red one, but he's done a red one now.
There you go.
So I'm happy.
Perfectly for you. But the Hyatt, you mentioned Hyatt there as well, Hyatt Denim, who are again, very story-based, because they're, you know, a good price for a jean, aren't they? They're 150, 200 quid or something, which is, you know, out the realms of feasibility for a bunch of people, unless you really bought into that the story behind it, the creativity, the story that adds value to the product, right? Because it's a pair of jeans at the end of the day, right? You can get a pair of jeans anywhere, but it's that depth, that story, that purpose behind it that adds the value to it, I think.
Well, David Hyatt, of course, will say, once upon a time, there was a factory in Wales that employed 4,000 people, that overnight Marks and Spencer's closed down because they moved all of the production to somewhere else. And that's a true story. And there's only 4,000 people in Cardigan. So 10% of a village was employed there. So he's not really saying, do you want to buy, you know this, he's not saying, do you want to buy a pair of jeans? He's actually saying, do you want to help 400 people get their jobs back? And that's the exact words that he says. And we, you know, I get that. And I like David. And, you know, the story of David, as we know, is David's old boss used to be Paul Arden. Paul Arden's mates with flipping Dave Trott. Dave Trott's mates was influenced by, you know, George Louis, and we go all the way back to Bill Birnbach. So it's the immensely beautiful, not some of the most beautiful storytellers in business communication, the most beautiful storytellers in business communication, fucking bar none. So that's where it comes from. And by the way, when you're saying, you know, oh, Mike, we referenced when you were talking about the commonality between the COVID adverts, I just nicked that from somewhere else. You know that I didn't produce that video. Yeah. I actually picked up my interpretation of the narrative and then it passed to you in exactly the same way as what Bill Birnbach was saying and Ogilvy for the first time, or what David Hyatt is advocating in a lot of his work today. Mm. We have to be selective with from whom we learn, of course. Because if we choose the duffers, then we end up as duffers ourselves. But these are masters of communication, in my opinion.
Yeah, they absolutely.
There's an underlying thing to the purpose, though, isn't there? That, you know, we anybody can think of a purpose and they can try and make it marry what you're trying to do. There's an underlying thing about real purpose in bringing your real emotions, feelings, and truth through to it. So the story there around, you know, giving 400 people their jobs back is more of a purpose than just a skimmed purpose on top. And I think alongside that, I think purpose is also moving now into yet another P, but I think it's purpose with the right principles underneath it. So actually the principle of giving 400 people their job back is more important than just the purpose itself.
I think so. And on that subject, Stella McCartney is quoted a very simple little observation. She asked somebody where the idea, the notion of purpose appeared in the business plan. And she suggested if it appears in the operations bit, you've got it right. And if it's in the marketing bit, you've actually got it wrong because you're using it as a veneer. So I always remember that because I build it into the operations, into the fabric of the way I do things. And then maybe I tell the story and then I'm judged on how well I tell the story or if the story is something that resonates. But that's where it manifests. But the tip of the iceberg, I would suggest, is in marketing, but the rest of the iceberg is actually operational.
Yeah. I listened to a podcast. You know, the Cannes Lions Festival has now got a podcast about its talks and stuff because there wasn't obviously an event this year. But there was a talk on brand purpose, which they banned the talk on brand purpose because of marketers have got hold of purpose and ruined it. And it's called, I believe it's called purpose washing now, like you wash your product and service in purpose, mm-hmm. hoping that some of it sticks. But the CEO, Alan, I think it's Alan Judd or Alan Jupp, but I'll correct that in the show notes, of Unilever did a talk on their stance on purpose and stuff like that, how by the year, I think, 2026, they're not going to have any non-purpose driven brands in their portfolio. They like a real strong stand about it. And I just wondered because there's an old saying, not my saying, that marketers ruin everything when they get hold of anything. And there was really good movement in and around Simon Sinek and purpose-driven brands. And there's people like Always Rare Ed and Hyatt and Painter and Patagonia and stuff doing really good purpose-driven work. But I think, I don't know if it's diluted now because marketers have got hold of it and everybody thinks there's purpose-driven Facebook campaigns and all that bollocks that goes with things. So what do you think this current state of purpose is? Does it come with a lot of baggage, Michael, in your opinion? Or?
Yeah, I think that we have to stay, as in with all areas of business, actually, not just business communications, we have to stay ahead because that sounds like we're manipulating change. You know that I, you know, somebody who is infinitely more clever, experienced and richly, and I do mean it, you know, richly knowledgeable about communications than me is Mark Ritson. The bit with Mark Ritson where I love listening to him and learning from him because I think some people you live like this and they're fishing from a pond of knowledge that's about like this. I think when Mark Ritson talks, he's talking from a pond that's immense. So he comes up with some very simple notions, but he fishes from such massive knowledge. Very clever man. But he discounts, this is really weird, and because what I'm about to say, you'd go, well, of course he would. He tends to discount purpose, it seems to me, because there's not a lot of evidence that it impacts on the bottom line currently. I'll tell you this, the reason I'm driven by purpose is because it gets me out of bed. It wakes me up. It wakes my brain up before I wake up, because I'm driven by the change I'm trying to make and not just by what I'm trying to do. And if people buy into the change, that's fine. But Mark Ritson will shine a light on a truth, which is the difference between what millennials say and what millennials do. Because too many marketers talk about, oh, the purpose-driven millennial, and the fact that, in fact, they're bigger and richer than any customer category in history. But what they say and what they do is vastly different. Because they will waffle on and join Extinction Rebellion and then go to fucking H&M. And they will. And by the way, H&M aren't the bad guys. But if you're going to, you know, they're oversimplistic. And I love Mark Ritson's eyebrows up, rock back in your chair, prodding them with a stick and saying, look, they say one thing and do something different. And he almost goads us as marketers to say, you fucking show me a brand that people love that's largely purpose-driven. And there are ones, you know.
Yep.
But I think that, and this perhaps goes back to what you were saying, Tim, that it's going to be more significant in the future, I think, whether we're rich or not rich, by the way, because we become more discerning with our purchases when there's less money about, and then we become a little more crazy, I guess, in the good times. But in summary, if you're asking me about the purpose thing, I kind of wish there was a different word for purpose, but us marketers keep making words up, don't we? So if we did that, we'd get bollocked for that as well. But I think it's just, I love thinking about, I don't just want to flog stuff for the sake of flogging stuff. I mean, you've heard me say, I'm a guy who's running a clothing brand, and I went into the category knowing that one third of all clothing made never reaches a consumer because it's considered unfashionable, so they bury it. I'm the guy who also knows that 90% of the clothes that you've ever bought and that I've ever bought, we don't wear with any regularity. And 70-something percent of all clothing gets incinerated or becomes landfill within 3 years. Yet I'm still going into the category where all of those are true. And it's because I believe in the buy less, buy better thing. I'm about to launch a little thing, and this, I'm sorry I'm going on a bit, it does link back to purpose though. There's a little thing which we're about to launch, which I'm calling it's called the One Project, we're calling it. It's an Always Wear Red thing. And we're basically going to say, look, if you could only own one of anything, what would it be? Because I want to be known as, if there's one hand knit, it will be one of ours. If there's one pair of jeans I'd have, it probably is going to be a pair of Hyatt jeans. If there's one, there's one kind of shirty jackety thing that I really want, it's a McNair shirt. If there's one pen, it's a little cross pen, but I broke it the other day, so they can sod off now, so I might get a different one. But the thing is, I wanted to suggest to people, if you thought about, we've only got one heart, so we kind of want to look after it. And I just think we look after things we've already got one of. These glasses I found in a shed, and I think it was 300 quid to have the bloody lenses in. And by the way, they're circular and they fell out the other day. So Lisa said, I'll put it back in. And I think she's put it back in upside down and they're varifocals. So I don't know what's going on. I've got it. But that's a side issue. But the point is, if I only want one thing, I just wanted people to think, look, man, why do you need all of these things? Because when we were doing flat caps, because our flat caps are between 110 quid and 190 quid.
Absolutely beautiful flat caps.
Well, you know what? They're made by the best maker. They're in Yorkshire, not unsurprising. Then we've got this silk underneath the brim. But I've had people say to me, 150 quid for a bloody flat cap? None of my 20 caps at home cost anywhere near that. And I go, do you not realise what you've just fucking said? You know, you've paid 50, you've paid thousands. It's that. I know our tastes shift, but...
But our tastes only shift with consumerism, don't they? So...
I think so, yeah.
It only comes as our taste shifts seasonally now, because that's the way the fashion industry is trying to drive us into thinking, because they produce it that quick, they want higher turnover, all those different things. And I think it's really interesting that you talked about wealth and wealth creation, because what determines wealth, some people it is money, but for a lot of others, like I would hazard a guess us three on here, it isn't money driven. It's not money driven for me. It's actually about doing good things is my wealth. And if we're doing good things, surely we're going to be in a better world.
When going back to what Tim was talking about as well, Steve, I'd like to do stuff that matters. A mistake I think I could make, as we all could, is that it doesn't matter to everyone, but it matters to a select few, and those are the people I talk to. Yeah. You know, if I was selling Marmite, I think it would be a mistake to constantly, continually, and exclusively try and convert non-Marmite likers to Marmite likers. Just talk to Marmite likers. We don't need to convert the world. Just, you know, if you're Marmite, talk to the Marmite likers. The current campaign, I think, is create a little bit mischievous, isn't it? Trying to hypnotize us to all like Marmite. So I get that strategic goal. But, if I'm doing 300 very expensive hand knits a year, I might be able to achieve that in my lifetime. You know, time will tell. We'll see. But I'm launching the website with a, for example, with a buyback facility. So if someone doesn't want it, I'll buy it back from them. I know how to refurbish it. And it's meant to last 50-ish years, in fact, based on a certain way of washing it, or not washing it more specifically, because of the antimicrobial qualities of 100% merino wool. All of that shenanigans. So I've thought, I think, about virtually everything I can to make it a virtually timeless, lasts lifetimes kind of thing, if you're into that kind of thing.
That's great. Like one of another chap I know, Jeremy Waite, who's works at IBM, again, we've mentioned him in the podcast, he's he did a beautiful video. He does the best one pages planning of a story of a presentation that I've seen, but he has a very similar outlook on the quality of stuff, but in to do with stationery, right? So he has A2 notebooks and beautiful Mont Blanc pens and the best artist pencils to draw and a ruler that was 40 quid. But he says, if I'm going to do beautiful, creative, valuable work, why would I use a pen that's 14p? Like, it doesn't fit. You want to feel your best while you're doing the work, right? You need to produce epic work, you need epic stuff. Do you know what I mean? And I think that leads on from just what you were saying, really. You know, it gives the work you produce depth if you've got that the whole kind of connectedness. Like, everything you do is about this, making the best piece of work properly, whether it's a jumper, whether it's a hat, whether it's a speech, a jacket, a pair of shoes, anything like that. I think that, you know, it's about having that connectedness, that there's a depth to certain products and certain offers that make a promise to you, right? Rather than just say, here's some stuff, you can buy it or not. But some, I would say, like, always wear red jumpers. They make a promise to you, right? Like, because they've got that depth for it, and you can prove that there's some, you know, there's some depth and matter and meaning that's gone into each product.
The interesting thing is, when I talk a little bit about the jumpers to people, and they haven't seen them yet because they're over there, you know, that they go, what are they like? And occasionally I'll go, have a guess. And they'll largely guess right. I bet they're bloody big. I bet they're bloody heavy. The cardigans weigh over 2 kilograms. Some of them have necks which are 11 inches tall. So if you want to escape from the world, there's one design, because it's a classically simple design. It has to be if it's going to last lifetimes. If it's going to be today's fashion or last, that's not the way it works. So my point is, going back to your point about delivering on a promise, if it's about timeless and you know, the way it makes you feel, i.e. it's hand knits that hug you is a phrase that we talk about. You can imagine what they're like already. And wearing a 2 kilogram jumper is, it's big, you know. And so, but it's meant to be, because to repeat, it is the jumper that, you know, if they say, oh, Tim, Steve, your phone's ringing. Can you not see I've got my jumper on? Oh, yeah, sorry, I'll just leave it then. That, because when we're going out to a posh event that we may or may not want to in our £4,000 Tom Ford suits, why are we wearing shite at those times which are arguably more important than any other, you know? And I'm not saying buy loads of jumpers, just buy one. And I don't use the word fashion, actually, because it suggests to me a transient feeling, fashion. Yeah. I will talk about clothing, but with an emotional connection, which I, in my opinion, Tim, that's what I think you were tiptoeing towards. The last thing I'll say, because I was thinking this when you were talking, the first incarnation of Always Wear Red stemmed back to when I was 14 years old. Forgive me if you've heard me say this before. But when I was 14 and Claire lived up the road, Claire was 16, so she was a woman, you know what I mean? Whenever Claire, they'd been talking, I was like, Mum, can you iron my special T-shirt? The one that as soon as I put it on, I turn into James Bond immediately, and Claire will immediately find me irresistible. I mean, she never did, of course, but the point was, it's that emotional connection. It's when we wear this versus that, when we use the Mont Blanc pen and the wonderful pencils you were talking about. For me, it's that. It's the way it makes you feel rather than delivering on the flipping left brain, the left brain part of it. It's the right brain bit that's most important with brand building, I think.
It makes me think of my grandparents, that type of approach. You know, I remember my granddad having the coal man's coat with the leather patches at the top and blue, but he had that for around 40, 50 years, you know, and he was never going to have another coat. And he had a flat cap that, yes, it started to wear after 12, 15 years, but he went and got it fixed and then he wore it again for another 10, 15 years. And actually, I think we all akin, when we buy things anyway, we all akin to try and have that, but then we just throw it in the back of a cupboard quite often. And I really like the idea of one jumper.
On this subject, I do mean this 100% sincerely. I can't remember who it was, but I had a conversation with a guy about a year ago and he said, I love your flat caps. I said, well, if you want one, have one, because we only made 10 of each. He said, I don't want one. I said, okay. He said, I want my granddad's shitty, oily, knackered one in the shed. And yeah, my words that were, I can't compete with that. That's the truth. Because even though I was there when the fabric was woven and they were hand cut and handmade, and then I picked up from London the silk myself and saw that hand, you know, there's only one factory in the world that makes the silk as densely, weaves it as densely as I wanted it woven, 300 strands per inch. That flat cap still was nothing compared to his granddad's flat cap. So, and I mean that sincerely, you can't compete with that. So I'm not creating a thing, I'm creating what it means to you. Nothing will mean as much as his granddad's.
You're not competing with that, but what you're doing is, your fingers crossed, is you're putting something in the market that in 50 years' time, the younger generations will want to be able to say, because that's what their grandparents were wearing.
It's the news stories, isn't it, I think?
You're creating a news story, and I think that's really powerful.
That's the plan. But, I mean, gosh, I'm worried about a mini backlash with people coming to beat me up when they find out how much these jumpers are, actually, because I've had a few people say they want one, and I thought, oh, I'm going to get beaten up, because they start at 12, I think, and then there's only two variables. You either put a zip in it or you have a high or low neck. And there's a sliding scale of what it costs between about 1,200 quid and about 1,600 quid. The knitters who hand knit them, by the way, we had a knitter drop out because she couldn't, her arms didn't work. And they're not little old ladies, by the way, but she said, they're so bloody heavy, I can't knit them. And this is a lady who'd been knitting for about 30 years, so we lost a knitter. When I say I lost a knitter, people think, oh, have they died? Because they imagine them
being old.
100 years old, yeah, but the most prolific knitter we have is a big, beardy guy, big, muscly fella. But why am I mentioning this? It's because the way they do the ones with the zip is they knit them beautifully and then they cut them right up the middle. I'm going, what were you doing? So they cut up the middle and then they magically do this thing. But with the zip, you know, we can't use YKK zips because even though they're the biggest, they're not the best. We have to use Riri zips, which are twice as much. But if you've got the best merino, blah, 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 and it's suddenly getting catching and it doesn't... Well, that's what I've chosen to do. And I adore absolutes. I love absolutes. Red is the colour with the longest wavelength. So it's the colour that the human eye sees before any other colour. That's one of the main reasons I use it, because it's an absolute, you know. I like the colour red for that reason. Yeah. But anyway, I'll calm down now.
I think that, you know, what I'm taking from this bit of talk about Always Rare Red and all the other cool stuff that we've mentioned is that, like, products or businesses or organisations, whatever it is, with meaning. I think meaning means more than purpose now. Do you know what I mean? Like,
definitely.
It feels like I can feel if it means something to me. If you say I've done this with purpose, I'm a bit like, okay, I can prove it.
We discussed that on series one, Tim, where I mentioned about Sky and the ocean plastics thing.
Yeah.
And when they jumped on the bandwagon of, let's talk about ocean plastics, let's reduce plastics in oceans, this, that, and the other, there was no meaning behind Sky wanting to do that. It was, they were jumping on a bandwagon that was there for them to jump on. Mm. And that frustrates the hell out of me when people do that. Yeah. I want people to feel it. I want people to have that emotion. I want people to, you know, they would do anything to right that wrong, or they'll do anything to give that person that better viewpoint in life. And when you get that, that's real purpose, not cloak and dagger purpose is the way that I always refer to it, which is just trying to slip something on the side.
Perhaps the best example of how involved people get with brands and what they really believe in my little world was, and Tim, you may not have seen this because it was a blog story I wrote about Apple about a year ago, I think. So basically, I'm lucky enough now that when I write a little blog story, 5,000 to 10,000 people a day will have a look. One story I wrote got about 1.2 million. And when that happened, of course, I thought, oh, every story I write from now on, I'm going to have a million people have a look. Next day, it was right back down to about 10,000 again. But it was a one sentence ish post about Apple. And I don't know if you remember this, but I basically wrote, because I felt it, this is what I felt, going back to your point, Steve. I wrote, and almost word for word, it was this. I wrote, I still love Apple, but I'm not sure that they love me anymore. And that's all I wrote. That's all I wrote. And 1.2 million people to this point have commented on that. Not commented, sorry, have seen it, and many tens of thousands, I suppose, of on LinkedIn. By the way, it wasn't on my blog. But the point was, it hits a chord with people, so I'm told by them, that they're going, yeah, I feel a bit like that as well. They were feeling a little bit just left behind. You know, this is the brand that, you know, and what we concluded, when I say we, but our conclusion was when the trailblazer and or the pioneer becomes the status quo, things change, you know, and how to manage that is tricky for them and it's tricky for us.
Yeah.
They changed the generation. Apple changed the generation, how people interacted, and people want to have that feeling again. They want that. They want the next version of the iPhone not to look like the last iPhone.
Yeah.
They don't want their MacBook battery to drop down to 5 hours because they put a touch bar in it. They want everything and more. And if you can't give the and more, then don't bother.
I think it goes back to perhaps Tim's point on delivering on the promise you're making, because one of the pillars of the brand is innovation.
Yeah.
So you have to innovate. So it's that, you know what I mean? And yeah, if it's simplicity, you have to keep it simple, or else you're not that brand anymore.
No.
That's why if I'm making a jumper that promises to make you adore your downtime, it's not going to be a piddly, lightweight little... I don't know, a man-made fibery thing. It doesn't work. And by the way, I hope that the sustainability credentials of what I'm trying to do will add to that feeling of... I actually wrote a sentence along the lines of, look, it's for people who no longer want to be part of the problem, because we're all part of the problem, and the problem, the definition of the problem is waste. But there's a cost for that if you buy my stuff and it's you're buying a jumper for 4, 5, 10 times as much as other jumpers, but hopefully it's that jumper you wear. And I also want it to age like jeans, you know, when your jeans get old. Hyatt are very good, aren't they? Because they go, I love the way David says, for the first couple of months, your jeans are going to feel horrible. They're going to be cardboardy. But it's always like, stick with it, you'll get there. And it's like, why? How have jeans suddenly become this cause thing? I didn't wash my jeans for 6 months. And okay, that. But yeah. It's good. I like it.
Yeah, it's good. It's good that means something. I was thinking with what Steve said about the sky thing, how people, like, it was very shallow, wasn't it? And I think that something that I see is the chasm between, like, commodity, whether that's product or service, right? Like commodity stuff and stuff that means stuff, it is getting really wide. I mean, we've used this chasm analogy for marketing agencies, right? Marketing creative agencies who just do stuff for money, and ones who do work that's important, right? It's like that one of the quotes I like off yours, Michael, that I was going to put in the show note, the pending show notes, was it's something like, why don't you stop making money and do something beautiful instead, or something like that, or something remarkable instead? Like, well, it's that feeling, right? Stop focusing on that stuff. And I think that there's definitely a move and an increasing gap between those two things, which is a good thing, I think.
I think it's interesting. When I was listening to you there, I was thinking about the disappointment I felt 2 days ago. And it wasn't directly disappointing for me. I was disappointed for them. And it was a brand which I love the way they think and behave is Oatly, you know, the Oatly.
Yeah, okay. The milk thing.
I like them because they have this very simplistic approach to how they do business. And it's based on fearlessness. And they define the enemy overtly as a brand who behave in a way that they don't. So it's kind of brewdoggy, kind of disruptive. Again, another overused word, I'm afraid, but kind of trying to lead the category. And then 2 days ago, the world said, do you realize they've just been bought by, I can't remember, and these are the shitty people that burn rainforests. And they came out and they said, but the money's enabling us to be more sustainable over here. But they didn't actually, they didn't timestamp the behavior of the company, which took me by surprise because I read the little thing this morning and it said, yeah, we understand that there has been that behavior by our parent company. And I expect them to say, but that's now, at least, has it gone? I don't even know if it's gone. I don't know if they're still doing it. But this is interesting because going back to my point, I was surprised how disappointed I felt. And in the pie chart of how I'm judging things that I buy, that little bit that where I care about provenance and behavior is getting bigger. And you know what? I often waffled on in the past about the reason it's a shit. I said to somebody once, and I wrote a little story about, a much better question than why is it so expensive is why is it so cheap? And the reason why people don't ask why is it so cheap is because they don't like the answer. By the way, with my brand, I have to have a good answer to why is it so expensive, and I'm comfortable with that. But the reason a chicken costs £3 is because a chicken is allowed to live its life on the size of a piece of floor the size of an A4 piece of paper before they slit its throat. That's the short answer of why it's £3. At the time when I wrote it, I was still buying £3 chickens. So I'm actually taking a little bit of time to catch up with myself. It's a millennial trait, and I'm not a millennial, as you know. But the point is, the gap between what I'm saying out loud and my personal behaviours as a consumer is closing, you know.
I think it is for many of us, isn't it?
Yeah.
The more that we understand and the more that that these stories are told to us, the more of a conscious decision we can make on things.
I agree.
And I think some of that comes back to the wealth again, though. You know, if you had, you know, 200, 300,000, 400,000 pounds spare in your bank every month, you wouldn't have bought a £3 chicken. And there's a lot of people out there who have to buy a £3 chicken. And that's fine, because you've got to be able to live to it. But I think if we can narrow that gap and make our conscious spend in the right places at the time that suits, then everybody would make that culture shift into buying the more expensive items, the ones that are more sustainable, the ones that are more conscious to the world.
There's an interesting case study on this, Steve, and it's a guy I was lucky enough to meet again at the Do Lectures, and it's the MD of Iceland.
Yes, who's brilliant.
So Richard, I can't remember his last name. I'm talking as if he's my mate Richard, who runs Iceland. My best mate, Richard, come over here a minute. So Richard said, he gets bollocked all the time because it's his parents' company, actually. So it's a family-owned business. They've got a 3% share of the UK market now, 3%-ish, which is quite big. And he says the shareholder value of a company that is not aligned to the buying behavior of the demographic that actually shops there, he gets told off all the time because, with all due respect to C2s, Ds and Es, which is actually they don't care as much about A's, B's and C1s as they do about the kind of things we're talking about.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is. You know, we'll not get into that today. But he said, look, I behave how I want to behave as a brand. And he's going, you know, I think this is the essence. A lot of companies, and this may go back, Steve, to your comments about authenticity. We didn't use that word, but that's how I interpreted it.
Yeah, no, it is authenticity. Yeah, definitely.
It's the fact that you don't wait for your consumers to bollock you before you get your act together. That's shit. That's bad. That's like what politicians do. It's not the fact that they were naughty. It's about the fact they got found out. Yeah. And all these generalizations and sweeping statements about politics and you know, brand behaviors here. But that for me is probably what I would say. You don't mend it when you feel you have to, as a marketing. It has to be in your heart. You have to believe it, I think. And that's where Richard wins. And that's why I kind of like Iceland.
Yeah, and that seeps through that whole company.
I think so.
There's a very big brand not far from me where my wife works, and they do frozen meals now in Slimming World, one of the biggest, you know, brands in the country by a long shot. I mean, their offices are huge, but they did frozen meals, and they had every supermarket approach them to stock them. And the person who, the CEO of Slimming World, chose to go with Iceland because of the feeling they got from them. And because of the way that they put their purpose across and how they wanted to help that demographic
yeah.
grow and lose weight and that type of things. And they've kept on that contract now for 3 years and haven't gone into Tesco's or into Sainsbury's or whatever. And actually those other companies like Tesco's have gone and made their own versions of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I kind of like that because I think commerce and margins and the numbers are clearly part of the decision, but if I've ever made money in my life, and by the way, my behavior now of I'm a Mr. 6 quid chicken guy versus a 3 quid chicken guy, I'm not poor or rich, and I'm not as rich as I used to be. I'm kind of in that middle bit. So I'm deciding, I'm making decisions in different ways. I've forgotten my point. But it's nice that the way we're making decisions and the way that brands are making decisions are at least acknowledging that we look a little bit further than the short-term gratification.
Yes.
Yeah. I think there's a really good word that I was listening to you two then for the last couple of minutes, and a word stuck out right from when Steve mentioned wealth the last time, and that word is choice, right? Mm. And I think true wealth is having the freedom of choice, right, of what you do when you want to do it. Right. That's what makes me feel wealthy. If I have the ability to choose my path, even for that day, like for that afternoon, for this afternoon, right? If I've got the freedom of choice, that makes me feel right, that wealthy, whether that's nothing to do with the money in my bank or anything like that, but that freedom of choice. And I think brands and products and services and stuff who create reasons to choose them, not just reasons to buy them. Like, because choose feels emotive to me. Buying is very transactional and shallow, right? You need a thing. You need a chicken because you've got dinner in a minute. you know, like it's not as good as choosing a £6 chicken. You're buying a chicken. Right. I think that choice.
I think it's a stretch on choice. So I think choice is, you've got to have choice, but the happiest I've been in the last year or two would have been when we all got locked down. So we were in very harsh restrictions and we still had to do what we had to do daily, but we had the choice to do it from home, realistically. But I think you need boundaries around choice, or you've got to have your own ideas to work inside that boundary. That choice with inside boundary is where I think that the real, I can't think of the word, but that real feeling comes through.
That's the thing, right? I've just spoke about it this week, actually, at a talk I did, but how constraints facilitate creativity, right? Yeah. The most creative are when you've got constraints. Like Michael creating Always Wear Red wanted to be the best hand knits in the world. That's quite constraining, right? There's very limited products and shape and ingredients of an Always Wear Red jumper that allows you to be, like, fulfill that promise, right? It's the constraints that foster
creativity. It's the same with the multiple agencies that Michael had, you know, you worked inside the constraint of that one agency, and then if it was outside of that constraint, you did it in a different agency.
Yeah, simply because I think that, as a general rule, generalists are beaten by specialists. I don't want my plumber to also be a joiner, to also be an electrician. I want her or him to be a bloody good plumber.
I've seen some terrible plastering from plumbers.
Yeah, that is that. But can I tell you, the one person who, just because of a tiny thing he said, and he's a love-hate character, I used to think he was great, now I think he might be a bit of a fruitcake or a fraud, I'm not sure. But Mourinho, when he was at Chelsea, said, my job is more difficult, in his second season at Chelsea, he said, my job is more difficult than any other Premiership manager because I'm aiming for one position. They're aiming for maybe that club is aiming for one of these five numbers, I'm aiming for one. And I always remember that because he was totally focused on winning. So you can only be number one. Number two is loss, and he actually got sacked 6 months later. But the point is, I think it's very important to know where you're aiming for, even if it sounds bonkers. But you know what? If no one else out there, in my opinion, and my opinion does matter, not because I'm me, but because I'm an individual, in my opinion, I can't find one piece of knitwear that legitimately, in the hand knit category, is amazing. So I'm going to go for it. And I think I also said, you know, I'm not a rich person, but I've already won because I think I've achieved it. If no bugger buys it, then commercially I'm rubbish. but you know, we'll see. But I believe in the product, and it's a nice thing.
Brilliant. That's awesome. That's really good. So that was so insightful. So many words to go in the show notes and stuff. But to round off this episode, Michael, what we do is we like to shout out either people or brands or things that are good or bad, right? And I think Steve, you had a gentleman to shout out, didn't you, Mr. Ken Robinson, and discuss?
Yeah, Mr. Ken Robinson. Ken Robinson's a bit like Simon Sinek to me. Oh, look, there you go. The book's up. Ken Robinson, new book.
You mentioned it before we were coming on air, so I thought I'll take it. I haven't read it.
Yeah. I was involved in education for a long time, Michael, and I was at my local college at the time, and we were showing the Ken Robinson Do Schools Kill Creativity speech that he did at TED. And it absolutely blew me away. It's one of those, it's like the Simon Sinek Golden Circles video. The first time you watch it, you just sit back and go, why have I not thought of this before? And I think creativity, and when I read your blog on 50-odd, the posts that I always gravitate towards first are your creativity ones, because I think it's a real key fundamental that everybody's got but is beaten out of us at some stage. I remember that there's an age-old myth that flies around, another great story, and around that a paperclip is given to a group of CEOs and directors inside of a company. And then a paperclip is also given to a group of five-year-old school children, and they're told to work out what to do with it. And the CEOs go, oh, we can clip it here, or we can open this up and we can open our iPhone and get the SIM card out. And the kids came up with like 50 different things. So it was, oh, it's a sword for my Barbie doll, or it's this, that, and the other. And I think, especially in this game, in marketing and telling stories, we've got to be really aware of how we can grow creativity again and try and get people to be thinking more creative as they go through life, rather than trying to drum it out of them and trying to get them to be more constrained, even though I've just said that I really like constrainment. But would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I try and simplify things because my memory is not very good, and my simple, it's just two words, and it's comparison and judgment. I believe that, you know, I had to work out where confidence came from and went to, and where creativity came from and went to. And I stumbled across a whole load of research on the fact that I asked a question. I'll ask you, actually, because you may not have seen it. I asked on my blog, and I asked a few people as well, at what age were you most creative? What would you answer to that, Steve?
I would say that I'm more creative now than I ever have been. Okay. Apart from when I was a lot younger.
What's a lot younger?
Well, anything before the age of eight is when, anything before the age of five, really. I think you're more creative as a young person because you don't know rules at that stage. Like you've got a young child, Michael.
Yeah, she's four.
Yeah, I've got a five-year-old and a nine-year-old. And you can see just between five and nine, the difference in creativity. So from, you know, the remote goes on the table at night. My five-year-old goes, but why does it go on there at night? Whereas my nine-year-old is, no, it must go on there at night. It's those little things that we drum in these rules from an early age. And that's what kills some creativity. But I think because of the last few years, because I'm in this game, all those different things, my creativity has actually widened. But I've forced myself to widen my creativity rather than
happening. Have you given yourself permission?
Yes, I've given myself permission.
I mean, the reason I used that rather contrived term, have you given yourself permission, is because when we did the research, the number was five. People consider themselves to be most creative at the age of four or five.
Yeah,
that was almost not 100%, but 80 something. And as I say, two words, judgment and comparison start to rise to the surface at that point. And one can consider, am I better or worse than that person, or what are people going to think? And rules, of course, I think was the other force at play. But I'm just going to mention this because it happened this week. There are three people inside Always Wear Red now. There's a commercial director and a brand marketer. And we're allowed to be, we've got to be stupid. We've got to do stupid things. We've got to say crazy things. And in fact, if we're not, we need to, it's not like get more drunk and let's talk more, although that is a strategy we may adopt. But this week, I said, I'm just so frightened of the price point. I said, you almost need a bloody account manager, because it's a 6-month span because most are made to order. So I said, if I'm buying something for 1,500 quid and it takes 6 weeks, I want an account manager. And we left that. And then we went back to it and said, so like a concierge type thing. I said, yeah, I'd want, and then it kind of distilled down. I said, I'd want a named human being to take me through, not just when I buy a jumper, but before that, how do I know it's going to fit? Tell me about all these things, because there's 23 different things that make it world class. Talk to me about those things. So the bottom line is, from today, we've written in, you may or may not use the word, I've not thought it through, but there's a concierge aspect to buying a bloody jumper. But
it's almost like a tailor, isn't it? It's going back to that suit analogy, and it's the same that the Italians used to do really well when making leather shoes, is you used to go in, get measured. It used to take 9 months for them to make your shoe. But they took you through every process. They took you through the colours. They took you through this. They took you through that.
And it hasn't got to be contrived. It's real, you know. It is probably 3 to 4 weeks, and exceptionally six. So I'll market it at six, because it could be 6 weeks. But the thing is, my point really is, it's permission to say silly things. I can't remember the 10 ideas we had that were ridiculous, but one of the apparently ridiculous ones, you need a bloody account manager for a jumper, that's become a real thing. And I always remember a story of where the guy, it was banks. Someone apparently around a table spat out, you know, if you want to go 24 hours, you've almost got to be able to reach through the wall and get your money whenever you want.
Yeah.
We know what that is these days, but apparently it was someone spitting that out that turned into cash points or whatever we call them.
I think those words that you said there, permission, and you mentioned it a couple of times, that in bravery is something that, like, because I do a lot of work with kind of leadership groups now, and some are in less creatively freedom roles like engineering and manufacturing, who are uber processy and uber operations delivered, and
the most creative industries in this country as well, but they can't be creative.
Yeah, they don't give themselves the permission to do, because in the beginning of the workshop, I'm just going, right, I'm doing the age-old 30 circles idea, right? I'll go, right, I have 30 circles, you've got 3 minutes to fill them in with a different circly thing. And they're going, what? All right, it's just so you give your brain permission to think a bit more outside of this room. And it takes permission and it takes bravery for to unlearn stuff, right? To unlearn constraint, like restrictive constraints, maybe, I think. But
I think it's judgment in comparison, even with the 30 circles thing, immediately, that it's built in. What are people going to think of what I'm going to write in my circle? And will it be better or worse than theirs?
Yeah.
So it's very strange. I do think those two things are a big barrier.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Right. Well, I think we've come to the end of the episode, gentlemen. So, Michael Owen, thank you very much for that conversation.
Thank you very much.
It was epic.
Thank you.
And we really appreciate it. We'll let you know when the episode is out and shout about it. And if you will put all the links to Michael Owen, the 50-odd, the Always Wear Red, his brand consultancy, a few of our favourite posts, and of course the Ken Robinson talk on TED, if you've not seen it, into our show notes. But thank you very much for season two, end of episode one.
No, it's not the end.
All right, thank you. So, Stephen, that was the first introduction into Mr. Michael Owen in real life, so to speak. If Zoom can be real life, I think it is now. But we've just interviewed Michael Owen for what I think is probably near an hour and a bit.
Yeah.
I'll
tell you what, there won't be much edited out of that either.
No, there's not much fluff in there, by the way. So I'm going to read just some of the single words out that I've scribbled on the notepad in front of me that have stuck. Proof and promises, confidence, pause, passion and purpose, meaning and choice, and constraint was a good one, wasn't it? And judgment and comparison he used at the end. Like so many really, really strong.
Like, do you know what came across to me inside all of it is he portrays he's so comfortable with himself in what he's trying to achieve. And do you know what, that when you stand back and you hear people talk like that, it's so nice to listen to. You could listen to stories that are all day long if they've got that confidence about what they're saying. Awesome guest. Absolutely awesome guest.
A real strong start, I think. And like you, Steve, I've been a fan of Michael for like the last 6 months. I didn't know who he was before. Like it's pretty much fine. But the more I consume, the more I believe what he believes, like Simon Sinek said, right? And he exudes, we mentioned it at the end of the episode, right? But he exudes having the wealth of freedom to do what he wants, to make the best in the world hand-knitted jumper when he's got no right to do it, right? He's got no, he's not.
Well, no, that's the thing. He's got every right to do it. He's just acting upon that right.
Like, we've all got the freedom to choose if we want to do something epic, right? Like Michael Owen is a very smart, a very clever guy, but he's an ordinary person like we are, and we're capable of remarkable things, right?
Yeah.
And there were so many lessons in there for business, and I know this is a marketing podcast, but
marketing is business, though.
Marketing isn't business, right? It's and marketing products and services and organizations with meaning is so much better than being transactional, and depth and meaning, that was full of depth and meaning for me, and will make.
I think that the thing that really shines through in all of that is we all refer to purpose, but actually doing marketing right is going beyond purpose, and it's all about meaning and principles behind purpose is where, as marketers, we should be spending our time.
Yeah, I think it's just such a strong start, and I'm you know, me and you are both into purpose, if that's the thing to say, and
not in a kinky way.
No, I very rarely meet individuals like Michael Owen, but in like who are living purposefully, there's no lack of depth, or you know, if you scratch the surface, it'd be something else, like the sky thing.
Yes,
that we mentioned, right? Like he is.
I know I keep bringing that up, but I mean I love Sky. Sky, I love the content that I can consume on Sky. I love how easy they make it me go and get the other streaming services and bring it into their ecosystem.
They didn't need to do that though. They'd just be a bloody good TV provider, right?
That was it. Yeah, you're awesome at providing TV.
Don't care about it. Like, stop about ocean. Put more programs on about saving the oceans is your bid to do that, right?
Perfect. That'd be perfect.
don't dilute. Don't go mad. Don't stop.
Don't stick an orca whale on the back of the Sky team jersey when they're doing the Tour de France, because it means nothing.
You've got access to millions and millions of people. Put more of the right stuff in front of them, right? It's the mere exposure effect. The more people you expose to it, the more often, the more rememberable you will be. Put that message for it. You don't have to say.
I think we're probably not going to get any sponsorship for this podcast from Sky, are we?
Sorry about that, Sky. But we love
it. Sorry, Sky.
Thanks.
If you want to advertise, please.
Netflix is on, right?
Yeah.
Netflix is on. Good. So we've got another guest coming up in the near future. We've got a few, actually. We've got Mark Asquith. We've got Matt Davies and some other very special guests. But that, ladies and gentlemen, was Michael Owen.
Yeah. So, now, like and subscribe the podcast.
Like and subscribe to the podcast. Like and subscribe to 50-odd blog, because it's awesome. And like and subscribe to me on social media and him on social media, I reckon. Right, that's it. See you next episode.
See you next episode.